You are listening to the Health Hack Podcast, powered by Lumen and hosted by myself, Caroline Pierce. As an athlete, sports scientist, and sports presenter, I am passionate about health and how we can unlock the skills to hack our full potential. Each episode, I'll be joined by a leader in the health and well-being world to learn how they've come to understand their body and turned that knowledge into power that could help you too. My guest today is one of the most educated women I know. She's a doctor of physical therapy and the director of rehabilitation at the very prestigious Monarch Athletic Club in Los Angeles. She's also a multi-sport athlete, and she specializes in functional strength, mobility rehab, and helping people live a pain-free and active life, which she's certainly done for me. Dr. Mario, welcome to the Health Hack Podcast.
Hi, Caroline. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
No, a pleasure. And just to put it in a little bit of context, so we met a couple of years ago when I started training at Monarch Athletic Club, and you've helped me with every injury I've had, from my hips to my knees to my wrist and everything in between. And I'm always in awe of your approach, because I think it's very unique to what a lot of people expect from physical therapy, in terms of just thinking we're going to lay down and be massaged or whatever it might be. And you have a very hands-on approach and so much knowledge. So I'm excited for our listeners to learn more about yourself and Dr. Mario Schofield. Sorry, I didn't give you your last name. Learn more about yourself and what you do. But give us a little bit of that background, because you were an athlete, as I said, but an athlete with diabetes. So it's a very interesting story as to how you got involved in physical therapy and what you do today. I'd love you to share it.
Yeah. So I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at age 5. And I feel like it's both a blessing and a curse, meaning if I didn't have type 1 diabetes, I probably wouldn't be where I am today navigating healthcare. And I was always really frustrated, and this will be a common theme today, is talking about what do I need to do in order to prioritize my health. And I felt like within our healthcare system, that's not necessarily prioritized, meaning how should I eat? How should I train? How should I be taking care of just the controllable variables in order to make sure that I'm creating an environment for optimal health? And I don't even like the word optimal, because I feel like nothing in real life is optimal, but
true.
I was just frustrated. So I think that really inspired this curiosity to learn more about the human body. So I ended up playing volleyball in college. I played at the University of Miami, and I had to end my career short because of complications with blood glucose management. And I think I was really unprepared to handle all of the stressors and all of the variables that influence how we function and feel. And that will be my common theme today, is like, I don't have a magic pill or a thing to bulletproof your body. It's more, how do we recognize these variables and what can we control, and how do we do that repeatedly over time? So that's kind of my story. I achieved my bachelor's in science in exercise phys and sports medicine in 2014, stayed at the University of Miami for my doctorate in physical therapy. I graduated in 2017, and then I moved to LA to start this multidisciplinary facility with a team of other healthcare providers that is Monarch Athletic Club. So
yeah,
really, really excited about what we're doing, because it's kind of like we preach behavior change rather than simple fixes or simple fads. It's more like, how do we adhere to the basics?
Yeah, that's what I love so much about, you know, what you do, what you do at Monarch as well. Just sort of on that note of, you know, your type 1 diabetes. We've talked about type 2 diabetes on this podcast before, but type 1 diabetes, just for people that don't know, or to reiterate, what is different about type 1 diabetes? And also, you said it ended your sporting career. What were the challenges or unique challenges that you were dealing with regard to that?
Yeah, so type 1 diabetes, they classify as an autoimmune condition. So, I mean, really, they don't fully understand the mechanism of how and why, but usually it's a combination of like genetics, maybe environmental component, and maybe even a viral trigger. And if that is up to date, somebody please correct me, but that's what I was educated on. Versus type 2 diabetes may have similar components, but also a lifestyle component. So we see more prevalence with increased rates of obesity and things that are more lifestyle oriented.
How did it inhibit your sports career? What was that challenge that you had to overcome?
In reality, transitioning from a high school and club athlete to a collegiate athlete, the amount of stress, both physical and psychological, definitely increased. And what's really interesting in my anecdotal experience is I tend to respond negatively to high bouts of psychological stress, meaning that will make my blood sugar crazy. And that's been something that, you know, we're high performers. We like to be the best at what we do, and we like to really exceed and be successful. So how do we manage that drive, that psychological stress, and also the amount of physical stress that we put our bodies through? It basically, I was hospitalized a couple times during my junior year, just due to really elevated glucose levels. And again, I didn't really have the support system to ensure that, hey, like, what are you eating? How are you sleeping? How are you managing stress? It was more just a very chaotic and uncontrolled environment.
God, which is difficult for an elite athlete or someone wanting to follow that path. So it's very interesting how you went about it yourself. You know, if that information isn't out there or obviously I'm going to find it myself and follow this path into what you're doing today. And we're going to get into that, as well as I'm excited with this conversation to talk about rehabilitation and that side of preventing pain and injuries or best we can. But first of all, we always start with a bit of a quick fire round. So this is just sort of a little bit of everything. I'm going to fire some questions at you, and just the first sort of short answer that you can give me would be fantastic. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Question for you. Do you eat first or exercise first in the mornings?
Eat first.
And just a follow up, is that because of the diabetes that you sort of important that you do get that fuel into your body early, or is that just a personal choice?
I think a little bit of both. I definitely notice more regulated blood sugar levels once I eat, but it also depends on what I eat too. So if I'm eating something that is super high glycemic or has a ton of sugar in it, that can negatively affect my blood sugar levels versus if I eat something that is more satiating, has protein, has more fat. And again, that's my experience. I'm not an endocrinologist.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Number two, what's your number one way to boost your metabolism?
I would say resistance training, having more lean body mass.
What's your go-to dish for a healthy meal?
I really like salmon. I do eat everything. So I'd say like either salmon or meat with a vegetable and some sort of low glycemic carbohydrate.
Yeah, tasty. What's your key to getting a good night's sleep? If you could name one thing that helps you get a good night's sleep.
A dark and cool environment.
Okay. And lastly, what's your biggest motivator for living a healthy and active life?
I think for me, it's survival. I mean, I know if I don't master these basics, then my likelihood of survival and longevity is decreased. So I think for me, it's personal.
Okay, well, let's get into some of the sort of injury and rehab conversations. What would you say is the most common injury that you come across at Monarch in your practice day to day? What seems to be one or a couple of the most common injuries that people come to you with? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that will say, yeah, I have that too. I can relate.
Yeah, I think the most common thing we see is low back pain. And I mean that more in like this non-specific low back pain, meaning there is no underlying cause for pathology or advanced medical interventions. It's more like I hurt myself when squatting, or I hurt myself when doing X. And that is something that is not only common at Monarch, but just in general, over 80% of people in the world experience low back pain at some point in their lives. So that, and also I'd say knee injuries, whether that's a meniscus injury, an ACL injury, or even just like osteoarthritis or patellofemoral pain.
And what are the, I mean, you just said with the lower back pain, because I was going to say, what are the biggest causes, do you think, of these common injuries? But it sounds like lower back pain, it's very non-specific. But other than that, are there things that we're doing in our day-to-day life or over time that are increasing our risk of these, you know, what's quite likely at some point in our life, back pain, knee pain, as you said?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting topic and something we've been diving deep into at Monarch. And really, the common misconceptions of the development of low back pain include things that are like structural. So whether that is like a herniated disc or stenosis, or even things like a leg length discrepancy, or you're quote unquote out of alignment, or I don't know, these false narratives that are spread by healthcare providers mostly, that we see no real association with the development of low back pain. Now, there's always a caveat to everything, but the more severe some of those things might be, maybe that increases the likelihood of developing low back pain. But we cannot reduce somebody's pain experience to a single variable. And that's what's really important about our philosophy at Monarch, is like, we are not trying to treat a pathology specifically. It's more, how do we get to know the human being in front of us? How do we get to understand their beliefs and their barriers to health and what might be contributing to those things, rather than just being like, oh yeah, you have a leg length discrepancy and that's the reason why you're in pain. Like, that doesn't help anybody. And it kind of creates this self-fulfilling prophecy of, okay, I'm never going to get better. And that doesn't improve self-efficacy and their ability or their belief that they'll get better. So it's really interesting. And I'd say, like, one thing we really don't do well as a population is just meet physical activity guidelines. Yeah. And what even are those guidelines? It's 150 to 300 minutes of moderate intensity activity per week, paired with 2 days of full body resistance training. And less than 20%, and in some studies, even less than 10% of those people meet, or of people in America, meet physical activity guidelines. So in my eyes, like, that is one controllable variable that we can all improve upon to at least better prepare ourselves for the activities that we want
to
do.
Yeah. Do you know what's interesting about that to me as well? And it speaks to what I said a little bit earlier about, I think a lot of people come in and they're like, well, just, if I just lay on your physio couch, you can correct my leg length, or you can do something and I'm going to walk away pain free, or you can tell me it's the way I'm sitting at my desk and I can get a nice little back support and I'm good for the day. But we have to put in the work, don't we? As the person that might be susceptible to or having these injuries, that there isn't a quick fix and it is a lifestyle change. How do people respond usually to that when you're telling them you've actually got to do this many minutes of exercise per week and all these other things in order to live this, you know, a relatively pain-free and healthy life as we all desire?
It's so funny because I feel like people hate it when I say that, and they really do want somebody to fix them. And we do a horrible job in healthcare to really kind of mitigate that, or I don't know, give better advice for that conversation. And it's really, really frustrating because there are a lot of healthcare providers out there who do say that this will fix them and this passive modality will fix them. This, I don't know, whatever, even system of exercise or my way is the best way, when really we don't have any evidence to support that there is a specific exercise or a specific modality alone that is going to even create a positive effect on that experience. Mm-hmm. So it just goes to show we really need to treat human beings as humans and understand better what are the variables and what do they think is even going on, to identifying what can we manipulate within this pain experience.
Yeah, that makes sense. At what point or at what threshold do you think most people come to you, you know, whether it's impacting their work, their life, their family, whatever it is? We all have a threshold, don't we, at which we think, okay, I can't take this anymore. I need to do something about it. Because I know for me, for many years, I've just sort of worked around things and just tried to sort of, oh, this is just how I, you know, I've got injuries from my career as an athlete. I've just got to deal with this now. And then there's a point we say, no, I have to do something about it. What do you think that threshold is for a lot of people?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, because I think if people understood what pain is a little bit better, that might reduce their need to go see a physician or go see a physical therapist. And they'd have a better understanding of, like, all right, most injuries do get better with time. And I feel like I might get some flack for saying that, but there are always things that we can do to better prepare somebody for the activities that they love. But at what point should they come see a medical provider for a pain-related injury? And I'd say, like, when other performance variables start to decrease, like they're less able to function at the capacity that they want to. Yeah. I think that's a good indicator to go see somebody. But also, if it's also associated with other symptoms, I think is also a good rationale to go seek help.
So you said at the beginning there, we don't necessarily always understand what pain is or something like that. What is it? You know, how would you describe it?
Yeah, I think, and again, even the healthcare community, we don't have a good consensus of what pain is. So pain to me is more of the reaction to a perceived threat or potential, and keyword potential, tissue damage. And that is nuanced. And it's funny because, I mean, we'll see people who have structural findings on MRI who have no pain, and then vice versa. So it's a very complicated process that or experience. And again, that's why we really have to understand who is this person in front of us? What are their barriers? What are their goals? How can we get them there? What can they adhere to? And I think those questions are vital in order to treating a human being, not just getting somebody's MRI and being like, okay, they have a herniated disc. I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. We don't have good evidence to support that. Even classifying somebody into a category of, all right, they have extension-based low back pain or flexion-based low back pain, that doesn't improve outcomes either. So we have to really treat the human being in front of us and understand where they're coming from and really collaborate on a plan of care that builds self-efficacy and independence.
Yeah, I like that. And there's different types of pain though, isn't there? For example, you get that DOMS, that delayed onset muscle soreness that we sometimes, you know, the good pain or the pain that shows that you've challenged your muscles to a greater extent. You've got that muscle soreness. And then you get pain that's related to having pushed yourself too far on an injury or a condition or whatever, as we've talked about. If DOMS, as we call it, delayed onset muscle soreness, so that, you know, you've done a leg day, for example, for people that don't know the term, you get up the next day, you can barely sit on the toilet, that kind of pain. Your thighs are so sore. Is that always necessary and a good thing to see gains in adaptation? Should we strive for that pain is what I'm trying to say.
Not necessarily. I think, you know, we commonly see that when you might acutely do more than you have done in the past, or maybe you're transitioning in between programs. But I don't think, one, it's anything to be afraid of, or two, anything to really strive for. I think of if I were to train to failure every day and induce that DOMS-like sensation, I probably wouldn't do very well. And it may potentially lead me to an injury down the road, just to more mechanical strain. But again, like a lot of these things, we can't really say definitively black and white, it's good or bad.
Yeah, it's one of those other misconceptions, isn't it? You've got to not be able to even walk out the gym to have done a good session. But there's also acute pain and chronic pain, and that's something else to distinguish, isn't it? Or know the difference between.
Yeah, even the more I practice, the more I even contemplate this. I think BJSM has an article on this about, you know, are you hurt or are you injured? And actually, one of my strength coaches in college used to say that all the time when we were like running and dying, and he'd be like, are you hurting or are you injured? And that's kind of the way that I think about acute versus chronic pain. Acute pain is more typically classified as like a newly acquired injury or tissue insult. So there might be objective signs of tissue damage, meaning like bruising, swelling, loss of function, weakness, things like that might indicate that there is an acute injury present, versus chronic pain is typically thought of in terms of time. So once you've hit this arbitrary 3-month time period, now it's chronic. And to me, pain is really not the best outcome measure. I think, especially when exercising, I mean, you're an athlete, you know, like there are days where you are pushing through periods of discomfort. And I think as long as it's tolerable and as long as 24 hours to 48 hours later, we're not seeing worsening of symptoms, meaning increased swelling, tissue discoloration, things like that, you know, we're on the right path.
Yeah. I remember as an athlete that, you know, I don't remember not being in pain. And like you say, I wasn't injured. I was just, you know, I'd pushed my limits, less so nowadays, but certainly back when I was competing in track and field and bobsled, I'm familiar with that feeling. And, you know, I spent a lot of time then on my recovery as much as I did my training, which we'll talk about. So talk me through your sort of process from when someone comes to you, there's either, you know, a tightness, a niggle, an injury, you know, chronic pain, whatever it is. What's the process that you go through from, you know, assessing that person through to whatever the treatment or practice or protocol might be?
I think this is really cool because one of the things that we offer at Monarch is unlimited access to our physical therapy, strength and conditioning, and medical team. Yeah. So luckily, we really have the luxury of time. And during our first assessment with patients, it's mostly conversational. So I'm getting to know who they are. I'm listening to them. I'm validating their experience. I'm reassuring them that they're going to be okay. And I might have to educate them on, you know, maybe these beliefs were told to you by a healthcare provider that may not be, or anybody, internet, friends, family.
Yeah.
It may not be that accurate. So let's dive deeper into that. And that process takes a lot of time. It's often not done right then and there. But at the end of the day, once we gather this information, it's how do we collaborate on a plan that's directed towards their goals and helps build self-efficacy? So a common theme of what we speak about is there's always a way to stay active around an injury and meet physical activity guidelines. So if somebody has an ACL injury or a meniscus injury, any kind of lower extremity injury, we're doing upper body, we're doing conditioning, we're doing things that still keeps them healthy or guides them towards health promoting behaviors. So I think that's really important and not often done enough in physical therapy. A lot of people think physical therapy is passive. It's very much do something to me in order to fix me, when that's not the approach that we take at all. So we try not to create barriers to movement by saying like, this is a good exercise or this is a bad exercise. It's more of how do we better prepare you to do the things that you want to do? And we're also not really preaching a ton of passive modalities or quick fixes that theoretically speed up the recovery process, because we don't have any good evidence to support that we should speed up the recovery process or that you even can. So I think that's really frustrating from my end is we'll have a lot of patients, and usually they're from like a higher socioeconomic status where they really want these advanced interventions or testing procedures. And we don't have a ton of research or evidence to support that any of those things really matter yet, or if they're influential. So I think education matters a ton. We really want to educate people on health promoting behaviors, set kind of realistic expectations based on the evidence, and help them gain a better understanding of the things that they can control in order to improve health.
There are all the sort of methods when someone's already kind of in pain or got a problem, and it's brilliant. But a lot of us, I think, want to avoid those situations in the first place. We want to bulletproof our body or prehabilitate our body as well, this sort of new idea of prehab as opposed to rehab that's sort of being thrown around. In a nutshell, are there things that we can do to bulletproof our body and protect us from certain injuries and issues?
I feel like everybody is going to hate me for saying this, but no, like there is no quick fix to bulletproofing. And certainly things like massage therapy, passive modalities, those things are not going to prevent injury. And it really bothers me when a lot of healthcare providers, physicians, massage therapists even say that, like, yes, my specific method, outcome, or passive modality will prevent injuries, because there's just too many things that we can't control for. So it's like, how do we create that supportive environment for managing pain, reducing the risk of injury, and improving health outcomes? And that's by repeating the basics. And kind of like, what are those basics? A lot of the things we like to talk about with patients are getting adequate sleep, staying hydrated, and eating adequate calories, meeting physical activity guidelines, not smoking or using addictive substances, and having meaningful social connections and community support. So I think in terms of bulletproofing your body, the only thing that you can really do is adequately prepare at an intensity that is greater than or equal to the task that you want to do.
Oh, I like that.
And preparation is key. And I think having this well-rounded support system of those things, like getting adequate sleep, eating well, movement, and putting yourself in a position to be successful is really important. Nobody's going to like me for saying that, but that's exactly what I think. And
no, I respect that. And, you know, you talk about those pillars of health, the sleep, but one that you said there was, what was it at the end? The sort of social and community part. Yeah, that's interesting, because normally when you speak to a doctor, you expect to hear physical interventions, but the importance of that social support is an interesting one as well.
Yeah, I think that helps from even just an emotional health perspective. That's something that is not spoken about much in the curriculum of physical therapy school. And it's something that is so important, is like, how do we manage psychological stress and emotional regulation? And actually sleep is a big contributor to that. So I think there's a bidirectional relationship between sleep and emotional regulation, meaning if you're not sleeping, you're going to be cranky. And if you're cranky, you might not be sleeping well.
I'm going to come back to sleep actually. But in terms of, you know, the bulletproof in our body, there's certainly, I know you're a big advocate of strength training, resistance training. Even at the top, I said, you know, what's your, you know, that was one of your answers in our quick fire round. strength training is, or functional strength training, as we sort of talk about now. I know that's a big part of what you do and at Monarch as well. Firstly, what is functional strength training? What does that mean? And how do we do it, essentially, if people listening aren't sure?
I love this question because the term function and functional has been thrown around a lot in our profession. And what does it even mean? And I don't really know. Like, functional strength training really, to me, just means I'm preparing for a specific task that I want to do. Yeah. And I don't think that we do a good job in our professions in, how do I say this? We like to create more barriers to movement by saying things are good and things are bad, when really, like, there is no such thing. It's how do we adequately prepare for the things that we want to be able to do, and also induce health promoting benefits. So the term function to me is kind of vague and ambiguous. I don't absolutely love it, but I think that's a good conversation that we like to have with patients. It's like, people are always afraid of squatting and deadlifting. And it's like, you don't need to be afraid of this. You're picking up your kids, you're picking up a bag of groceries. They're just different strategies to pick up things.
So it's replicating movements that we do in our everyday life, but adding an amount of load that strengthens us for that particular task.
That's a good way to put it. But I think what the most important thing is really dispelling the myth that there are good and bad exercises. Yeah. Like, you see those posts on Instagram where it's like a check mark and an X. And it's like, I hate those, because we're really creating more barriers to movement, and people don't need that. They need to be more physically active. That's definitely interesting that you brought that up.
Well, I always find it interesting as well that we do this whole don't have your knees going too far over your toes situation as well. And I don't know what you think of this, but in life, there's situations where my knees will travel ahead of my toes. You know, I could be dodging shoppers going down the high street or the, you know, whatever, and I've got to move quickly and I've got to change directions. So if I'm not conditioned or I'm not used to doing that, because I've always been told, keep your knees over your toes, don't go past this many degrees in your squat, I'm not going to be very good at life when it comes to life throwing obstacles at me. So I always think that as well. You know, actually, the stronger you could be in all different directions and positions is probably better than sometimes this, what we consider perfect form, that isn't always what we do in life. And it's probably a reason why myself personally, and a lot of people I know, get injured, not through training, but by doing things in life that have put us off track a little bit, you know. So I've done all these perfect squats with all these pounds on my back, but then suddenly I'll squat down to pick something up off the floor at a funny angle and my knee's gone again. So
it's so funny because, yeah, like I said, there is no such thing as good or bad. It's just, are you prepared to do it, and are you recovering adequately? And those are two things that in theory sound easy to monitor. They're not. But I think as people in positions of authority, we need to do a better job of educating patients that movement is okay, getting stronger in all these different ways is okay, and you should go and do it, rather than just being like, don't do it this way, only do it this way. That's confusing, and it's just not very smart.
Gives you a bit of freedom actually thinking like that. I like that. What about mobility training and the importance of that, you know, your static versus your dynamic stretching, your full joint range, all those different ways to stretch?
Yeah, I think mobility training has been really emphasized in the past couple of years just through different systems that really, really preach it. And I do think that movement is important, and having active range of motion and strength within those active ranges is important. But I also think that the best way to do that is to get stronger in those positions that you're trying to get better at moving through. So I think I don't do a ton of static stretching or preach it. I think if it's something that maybe allows somebody to feel a little bit better in that movement, I'd rather have somebody do that than spend $500 on a double-handed massage. In terms of achieving better health outcomes, resistance training and meeting physical activity guidelines is like the best place to start.
Yeah. And also, I've seen you squat. You need a lot of mobility, or squatting itself's mobility, when you squat as deep as you do.
Yeah. I think what's interesting is that wasn't a big emphasis within my training until maybe I went to physical therapy school, and that's something that they preached a lot. But the way I got better at it was by doing it. Luckily, growing up, I had a really good strength coach. We started lifting in middle school, and that is unheard of. People are so afraid to load young people when really, again, there's no evidence to support that there's anything bad about that. But during my volleyball career, we started lifting at a very early age. And I think that is the reason why my overall injury, I guess, prevalence incidence was less. But yeah, it really helped prepare me to be a good volleyball athlete.
What about the notion or that I'd heard in the past was that if you start strength training or loading up too young when you've not developed or grown or, you know, your muscles are still developing and tendons and joints, that's a negative thing. You sort of dispelling that idea?
Yeah, I think that research came from coal mining studies. And it's like, what else was going on in those coal mines? It was more like, okay, I'm deprived from the sun. I'm deprived probably from a lot of nutrients. I'm exposed to a lot of adverse environmental, who knows, chemicals, whatever. And that would probably impact somebody's development more so than actual lifting.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So, yeah.
We have these things that get stuck in our head for many years and they're not always questioned or, you know, the rules aren't rewritten, if that makes sense. But I do want to sort of pivot us from, you know, let's talk about these different pillars. We've talked about physical activity, mobility. Nutrition is obviously a big part of, you know, living an active and a healthy life, should I say, and a big part of what you do at Monarch as well. But again, back to your own experience and how you've had to adapt your eating as an athlete, as someone physically active with diabetes, how do you ensure that you are fueled adequately for your training sessions? Or I've seen you with those little pouches that you sometimes have to eat during the day, like a sort of glucose hit. So what do you have to do around your diet in terms of making sure you're adequately prepared for training?
Yeah, this is the hardest part for me, for my personal health management, is eating at consistent times. One, always having snacks because your blood sugar may drop whenever and you need to be prepared for that. But eating at consistent times and in general, just mastering the other basic things that we've talked about, like having a consistent sleep schedule, having a consistent work schedule, taking time in the day to like actually check your blood sugar, make corrections, eat. Those things are alone seem really simple, but you know, starting with a new business and trying to do all of the things that you want to do it's been really, really challenging. So yeah, I think some pillars for my own personal health in terms of nutrition is I don't totally avoid carbohydrates or sugar or any of these things. I think, you know, it's very hard to kind of be on that extremist type of lifestyle, but I do like to eat adequate protein. So some things that we recommend even to patients are 0.7 to 0.8 grams of protein per pound of body weight. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a minimum. And so I think eating foods that are higher in protein and may have more fat with carbs that are lower glycemic tend to work better for me. Again, everybody's different. A lot of people have tried like keto or intermittent fasting or all these other things too. And I think maybe those things might have a place in certain contexts, but if we're not doing the bare minimum basics repeatedly over time, that's probably not going to influence as much.
Yeah. So you've recently been using Lumen, our metabolic tracker, and you found some really interesting results for yourself, didn't you, with regard to your fat and carbohydrate burning as someone with diabetes? Like, share that with us because I found that really interesting as well.
Yeah, I do not ever, or up to date, have not ever burned fat according to the Lumen. And it's interesting because even in, I'll talk about the study where they looked at body composition and respiratory quotient. So really a respiratory quotient is someone will breathe into a device that measures whether or not they're burning fat or burning carbohydrates.
Yeah, usually which is what Lumen does, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's closer to 0.7 indicates you're burning fat versus closer to 1 indicates you're burning more carbohydrates. And whenever I test the Lumen, I'm closer to that. On the Lumen, it measures it in like numbers, like 3, 4, or 5. I'm always in like 4 or 5. I'm always burning carbohydrates and I'm not as able to burn fat. But what's interesting is there's a study on sleep and that shows that when people are sleep deprived, so this group only slept 5.5 hours a night versus 8-ish hours per night, the group that was sleep deprived was less able to burn fat and they actually lost more lean body mass than the group that slept for 8 hours a night. So I think there's a lot of caveats to that article. And I wonder if they were resistance training during this 2 week time period, if that would have changed anything. But it's just interesting to highlight, like, yes, we need to do these basic fundamental things repeatedly. And if we don't, that might be more of an indication to do better at that rather than to seek these magic pills or alternatives or hacks or whatever it might be, you know?
Yeah. That knowledge is always key, isn't it? And I know with the approach you take, it's very individualized for your clients, for yourself as well, obviously. And what are your uses and thoughts on trackers in general? Because I know we both use several of them, from Lumen to Aura to all these different things. How valuable do you see them, and how important are they for you in looking at your clients individually?
Yeah, well, I mean, my most important wearable is my continuous glucose monitor because I'm type 1 diabetic. And I think that to me is like an absolute necessity. However, things like the sleep trackers, like Whoop and Aura, I'm kind of mixed on. And I'll tell you why. I think, one, it's not necessarily that accurate when it comes to measuring calories or total daily energy expenditure. I think that those trackers are not the best for measuring those things. But also, I've seen a lot of patients become obsessive about things like sleep scores, and it induces this acute bout of anxiety that might even hinder sleep. Yeah. And I know I've even been that way. But on the positive side, I think it can be beneficial to help people make behavior change. And what I mean by that is, say somebody goes out and they are drinking a lot, and then they wake up the next day and they look at their recovery score. Oh, my resting heart rate is high. My HRV is low. I slept like shit. So
not burning any fat, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that can be used as a tool to educate people. Like, yes, these things are important. Maybe it might spark some behavior change, but overall it's kind of a gray area of, is this absolutely necessary to be healthy? I don't think so. But it's a nice thing.
Yeah, I think it's about having a healthy relationship with something like that and not becoming obsessive over, you know, over data, but using it as a bit of a guide and an insight into your body and what changes you might be able to make. Because I think especially if you're stuck, if you think you're doing the right things, training, eating, etc., but the results aren't coming, I think it's sometimes nice to get that little insight into what's really going on in our body. Something that I found really interesting as well, was looking at blood work and hormones and improving metabolic health in that way. And I had my blood work done at Monarch, and it showed that my testosterone levels were a lot lower than I thought they would be. And it sort of explained a lot of things with my energy levels, and then sort of took me on a course of how I could eat and train a little bit differently to improve that. And that's another thing you do, isn't it? It's that whole 360 approach to wellness, from physical therapy to training to diet, and also the helping to improve our metabolic health through looking at our hormones and so forth. Like, can you talk to that a little bit in terms of looking at the approach, you know, from every angle, including our hormones?
Yeah, well, I think one, a lot of that is outside of my scope of practice, so I won't touch on it.
No, but you have experts, don't you, within the club that do, yeah.
Yeah, so what's really cool about Monarch is every member who comes through the door meets with our physician, and he conducts basically what we call a comprehensive metabolic panel. So we're looking at glucose, liver, kidney function. He'll conduct a lipid panel, another test like thyroid function if indicated. And a lot of other tests can be done if people are presenting with signs and symptoms that might indicate that test is warranted. But at least we're getting a basic understanding of how are these people presenting and what behavioral changes can we induce to help get them to where they want to be. Mm-hmm. And after they meet with our med team, they meet with our rehab team, and we discuss kind of the same things that we've been talking about, like who are they, what are their goals, what are their barriers, what are their beliefs, and how do we come up with a plan of care with keeping in mind maybe some surgical history or sensitivities that are present.
Yeah.
And then they meet with our strength and conditioning team, and we're looking at basic movement competency. We do a VO2 max test. And once those assessments are complete, we all sit down and we come up with a plan for this person. Yeah. So it's really cool. It's really collaborative, and I absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's a real team effort. Mm-hmm. And just going back onto the nutrition side of things as well, and what you do with physical therapy, can we eat for recovery, or can we eat to prepare ourselves for treatment, whether that be hydration, whether that be certain foods that we eat that will better our results, if you like.
Yeah, I think common themes that we talk about with patients are protein and hydration. And hydration, we usually recommend anywhere from half an ounce to an ounce of water per pound of body weight. Protein, we're recommending a minimum of 0.7 grams per pound of body weight of protein, so per day. And these things are, again, staple principles. Those numbers might change depending on somebody's goals or activity levels, but those are the minimum guidelines that we're preaching.
And why is the hydration part so important? I mean, we all know and we're all told how much water we need to drink a day, et cetera. But when it comes to our recovery or our, you know, just general condition of our tissues, why is the hydration part so important?
Some studies have showed that dehydration can impact things like performance and even the way that you feel. Like when you're dehydrated, you are definitely not feeling great. Yeah. So those two areas can definitely improve somebody's overall sensation of wellness and also performance and health. So other things in terms of nutrition that we like to preach are just eating whole foods, trying to reduce like highly palatable foods. So things that are really tasty are often easier to overeat. Mm-hmm. And
it's true.
Yeah. So getting your nutrition from whole sources and just making sure that we're eating adequate calories.
Yeah. And then, you know, we've touched on it a few times, but sort of to finish up with the whole sort of sleep and recovery side of things as well. Sleep comes up time and time again, the importance of sleep, as you mentioned in that study there, in terms of our body composition in that study. How do we ensure that we get a good night's sleep? At the beginning of the quickfire, you said about creating a dark environment, but what else mm-hmm. can we do to help us with that? Because it's so important.
The basics of sleep hygiene is essentially having some sort of wind down routine, right? So reducing the use of electronics, reducing any stimulants or caffeine intake in terms of even quantity and timing. So usually we recommend not consuming caffeine after about like 1 p.m. ish and reducing the total amount of caffeine to less than 400 milligrams of caffeine per day. And that's a lot. But
how much is that 400 milligrams? How many cups of coffee would that be?
I think that's five cups.
That's a decent amount, yeah. Actually. Yeah.
Yeah. And being in a dark and cool environment, so ideally less than 70 degrees in your sleeping environment is important. I also think it's important to keep your sleeping environment solely for sleep. So I don't recommend like doing work in bed or watching TV in bed. I think that can be detrimental. Reducing your exposure to things like electronics, TV, blue light, and having a consistent sleeping schedule or routine. So going to bed at the same time, waking up at the same time, I think is also really important.
Oh, there's so much to it, but it doesn't have to be hard, does it? You know, when you talk about sleep and food and, you know, it's just about following good general principles. And I think sometimes we try and overcomplicate it. And I'm asking questions that are like, give me that magic pill or that bulletproof solution. And it's just a lot of consistency, accountability, and I love the way you bring all that together. It really is insightful. And before I let you go, though, I also want to talk about the fact, you know, we're doing a little bit of a women's series here as well with the podcast, and you are very pioneering as a woman. You've worked with professional sports and been in professional sports, and you're in a very male-dominated environment as a physical therapist a lot of the time. How challenging has that been? And also, what advice would you give to other women that want to follow in that field? It's very inspiring.
Oh my gosh, Caroline, you are opening up a can of worms here. I think, you know, it can be very, very frustrating and discouraging to be a woman in our healthcare system and just in athletics. It's not something I ever thought that I would encounter, but over the past couple of years, it's really been apparent that, you know, people might think less of you or say really negative things about you or even try to criticize you based on your appearance or whatever preconceived notions that they have about you. And the best advice that I can give is just expect that that's going to happen and think about how you're going to respond. Because you can't really control for what other people do, but you can control the things that you do in response to it. Yeah, I think sometimes I wish I was a boy, but
no. Don't say that, because you're paving the way for a lot of other women that want to be in this field, and why shouldn't we? You know, and I know I've always been very inspired by you, and like I said, you do such fantastic work. Before you go, tell us where we can find you and more information about you and what's coming next.
Yeah, I'd say I'm most active on Instagram. So my Instagram is marielle.dpt. You can also interact with us at Monarch Clubs on Instagram, and our website is just monarchclubs.com. So if you want to find me, that's where I am.
Appreciate it, and appreciate you. Thank you so much for talking to us, Meryl.
Of course. Thank you, Caroline.
And thank you for listening to the Health Hack Podcast with myself, Caroline Pierce. Each episode provides a healthy dose of health hacking, so make sure to hit subscribe or follow so you don't miss out. I would be truly grateful if you could rate and review wherever you're listening to help others seeking inspiring stories and health hacks to find us. The Health Hack is an Insanity Podcast production and powered by Lumen. See you next time.